members of the committee for nominating me as the chairperson, for the day. So, but what is critical here, we've got an agenda before us. We've got two entities which are going to give us a briefing. The first entity will be the National Credit Regulator, and the other one will be the National Consumer Tribunal. I think that it is of paramount importance that as the portfolio committee must be briefed, we know that the financial crisis which hit the entire globe has implications for all the countries of the world. So as the national regulator, credit regulator, we know very well that they've got a very important role to play, in particular to ensure that the credit flows, but that credit must also be a responsible credit, which must be awarded to the people. But what is also very critical is that we know very well that there is no economy which can thrive without the credit being available for the consumers, because the credit is like the lifeline of any economy. So it is critical that we get the presentation that how much did it affect us as a country, and what are they doing to mitigate any negative factors which are undermining the growth of our economy. So, but at the same time, we also have to deal with the issue of the rights of the consumers themselves. How are they being protected? How much did they do up to this point? Because I think that we, as South Africa, were able to withhold or to withstand this turbulence better than other countries because of the regulatory environment we're having within the country. So let us get a briefing from them so that they can show us how well we must act as Parliament, so that we supplement the work they are doing, so that at the end of the day we know that we grow the economy, so that at the end of the day our people are going to benefit. So we are having the delegation from the NCR. We are having the CEO, who is Mr. Gabriel Zabel, and then we are also having the Senior Manager Education and Strategy, Mr. Zita. And then can they just introduce themselves?
Gabriel Zabel is here. Zita is the Senior Manager responsible for Education and Strategies. That country will be one of the areas I'm responsible for.
Can we have on the side of the National Consumer Tribunal, which is headed by Ms. Diane Kerr-Blanche, can she introduce the delegation she has come with you?
Good morning, honorable members. I'm Diane Kerr-Blanche. I'm the chairperson of the National Consumer Tribunal. With me today is Ms. Hazel Devrange. Hazel is the CEO of the National Consumer Tribunal, and she also fulfills the role of registrar and chief financial officer. The third member of our delegation is Mr. David Scrooby. He is the case management unit who provides support on the legal aspects to the tribunal members. Thank you.
So I think now we can go straight to the presentation which they are going to according to our program here, is that this portfolio committee is going to sit until 1 o'clock. So it means that we might have time. I think that the maximum time for presentation must be at least 40 minutes maximum, so that we really, after that the members can engage with the presentation of that. And then after that, we'll go to the National Consumer Tribunal, and then the same, and then we'll engage with that. So I'm going to give us a presentation. All right, the CEO.
Okay, thanks. Thank you, Chair. I'll go through the presentation. If the questions, Peter will kick in on all the debt counseling related stuff. Summary on the top, you can really see is what we're trying to link it back is to what it is that we're trying to achieve through the Act. And you obviously see, hopefully you've seen the kind of awareness campaigns that we are trying to create, which will become relevant, you'll see through the presentation. What I've done in the presentation is I've looked at three different aspects. The one is the financial impact of the financial crisis on the credit flows.
Can we have one with you, please?
the first set of slides deal with the numbers. How did the credit flows change since the start of the financial crisis? Then there's a set of slides that come from specific research that we as the NCR has mandated on the impact of the financial crisis on the consumer credit market and on consumers themselves. And the bulk of the slide at the end is actually got to do with debt counseling and the role that debt counseling must play in respect of assisting consumers in dealing with the resulting debt stress as a result of the financial crisis. As part of that, we will also talk about certain problems that you probably would have seen in the media, and specifically problems in terms of the current context of the National Credit Act as it relates to debt counseling. I'll just kick off. This is just the overall summary. I'll unpack it as I get along. Just the first broad point is that since the start of the financial crisis, the statistics that we gather on credit provision indicate that the gross volume of loan disbursements in South Africa has about halved, where it was in the order of 102 billion rand per quarter in the last quarter 2007. In the most recent quarter, the June statistics show that it is just over 50 billion. So from 102 billion reduced to around 50 billion. So obviously a huge impact on the economy as a whole. In terms of the impact on consumers, and I'll just unpack this a bit later, but the broad conclusion that we've come to is that the biggest impact of the financial crisis is really on the middle high and high income consumers. If you took it in monetary terms, consumers most directly heavily affected will probably be the consumers earning from 6,000 to 17,000 rand a month. Adding to that, though, the category below them and the category above them will also be fairly heavily affected. I'll disaggregate it just now, but the general perception, the general conclusion, the job losses are probably even bigger in the lower category. But in terms of debt stress levels, the issue is not just job losses, it is job losses for people that are already owing debt as well. So the really crux of the debt stress will come from those categories of consumers where there's a high risk of job or income loss as well as high debt levels. The third point they're making, and this is like the overall summary, is that there's three areas where we think it is critical to intervene from a policy perspective. Number one is a national awareness campaign, and not just general messages, very specific messages to equip people with the kind of information that they will need if they lose their job or if their income reduces. Because what we find all the time, and people can talk about it a bit more later, is that if someone's income reduced to the point that they can't service their debt, or if they have job loss, they start panicking. And when they panic, they do the wrong things. They cancel the insurance policy that they shouldn't be cancelling. They use the retrenchment package to pay off debt, even if they've got credit life insurance. I'll get to the detail, but so the point is we must give people the kind of information they need before the calamity strikes, so that if something goes wrong, they have the information with which to deal with the crisis. The second thing that, in terms of a policy response that we think is very important, is to make sure that debt counseling work. In South Africa, we have a mechanism to deal with the individual impact of the credit crisis. Then when individual consumers lost their job or lost their income, it will probably be common over-indebtedness problem, and there is a debt counselor to assist. But it must work. Currently, there's really big problems. The third issue is to explore whether it is possible to get special mechanisms to protect the residential property. If someone is over-indebted, is there any way that we can resolve the over-indebtedness, get the person to sell the car, to do whatever, but to try to protect the residential property? And the fourth point there, that is really the core of the last bit of the presentation, is the point we're making there is that there are currently legal problems that are inhibiting the effectiveness of debt counseling, fairly big legal problems that we would urgently need to address. Let me move on. The first next couple of slides are now going to look at the next couple of slides look at the statistics. These are, you hopefully may have seen it, the statistics that we at NCR get two sources of statistics. We get statistics both from credit bureaus that we get quarterly and that we publish, and we get statistics from all credit providers, banks and others, that we again get quarterly and that we aggregate and we publish, which give us one of the, which is where our indicators come from on the impact of the financial crisis. As an overall picture, this is just in between. Sorry, the slides are doing their own thing. If we look at our credit market in total, we've got about 1.1 trillion rand of outstanding debt in the consumer credit market. Please remember, anything of us here, we talk about the consumer credit market. There's around 3,700 credit providers, around 31,000 branches. This is all registered with the NCR. They provide credit to in the order of 17 million credit active consumers. That's the total population of people that have some form of credit. And currently we've got about 1,200 debt counselors that registered, who obviously, as per the provisions of the National Credit Act, have to deal with cases of debt stress or overindebtedness. Now, getting to the crux of this thing is that if you look at the top right hand slide, that will show that it gives the aggregate consumer credit disbursements per quarter from the last quarter of 2007 up to the most recent quarter, the June quarter, preliminary statistics. And it would indicate to you that from the left-hand side through to the right-hand side, the extent to which every quarter the gross credit disbursed have declined. Declined from, as I said, around in the order of 102 billion in the last quarter 2007, up to 50.9 billion in the most recent, the June quarter. There's been some confusion in the public debate around this issue. Some people have said, well, we've not had credit decline, which is not quite true. If you look at the next graph there, it shows you the outstanding loan balances. Despite the decline in credit granting, the loan balances have still grown, and that is very usual. It just grown more slowly than what it would have grown otherwise, and also to note that if people fall into arrears, the loan balances would in any case still grow, even if no credit is granted. So we have most definitely in the consumer credit market, and this is the statistics that we reconcile, it's also just to interrupt myself, our statistics get reconciled with Reserve Bank statistics before we publish them. So I've got little doubt on the validity and the consistency of these statistics. The last point on that slide to make is just that the biggest declines we've seen is really in mortgages and motor vehicles, and mortgages in particular. But it is the single category where the decline in credit is the greatest. But let's do take note that if you look at the last two quarters, the March quarter 2009 and the June quarter of 2009, that it seems to have stabilized. So maybe we would now start seeing the credit disbursement starting to pick up a little bit. Why has the credit disbursement declined so much? There's two different reasons. The one is that consumer applications for credit has actually declined. Consumers are cautious. It is not just the banks that don't want to lend. Consumers themselves are cautious. The volumes of consumer inquiries for credit, if you look at the left-hand side of that graph to the far right-hand side, you can see how these volumes have come down. Please remember seasonality as well. In December, you'll see there's a bit of a spike. You always find December applications a bit higher. But there's also been an increase in the levels of rejections by the credit providers and about by banks in particular. Not a huge increase, it is about a 1% increase, but there has been a slight increase in the rejections. But obviously, if you combine the effect of lower volumes of applications with increased rejections, you have the end result of fairly big declines in gross volumes of credit. Now, this slide is, I'm throwing the ball now completely to the other side. These slides, these statistics come from the credit bureaus, which basically means it is a summary of all the credit bureau records of all South Africans together, of those 17 million credit active consumers. And where you can see is that the level of what is called impairments. Impairments mean the consumers that have some or the other negative information on their record. They've been falling into arrears. They've not made payments, or they may even have received a judgment, or they may have had a notice for non-payment. The volume of impairments have been growing every single quarter. On average, if you look at comparing the last quarter 2007 to this recent quarter, 50,000 people per month have been added to the impaired category. So for 50,000 people per month, their credit position has been worsening. So if we want to, if we start fighting with the banks for not lending, we have to remember this context as well. The banks are facing a reality of the consumer's debt stress and ability to meet their repayments being undermined. One last point to make on this slide is that, just to note that this is not, when we're talking about credit active consumers, we're not only talking about people with credit agreements. This includes people's cell phone records, people's municipal service records. It includes the doctor's accounts and the dentist's accounts that goes into it that are not paid. All of this is included in this 17.8 million. Because in some of the later slides, the worsening position here is actually worse than what you see in the bank or the credit provider statistics. What it means is that there's actually a big volume of people in the country that are probably not making their cell phone payments, not paying their school fees, much bigger, not paying their doctor's accounts or dentist's accounts. If you look at the debt counseling statistics, it's not in here, but you'll find the numbers of people that are not paying the doctor or the dentist, and therefore are getting the fees by you. So the problem is much bigger than only a credit market problem. Now, shifting to the second set of slides, which are the slides that you, let me, where this comes from is we, in November last year, we appointed a research firm, Feasibility Consulting, to do specialized research in terms of the impact of the financial crisis and the expected impact of the financial crisis on the South African consumer credit market in general, and in terms of the impact on consumers specifically. The research involved a whole host of engagements with various economists, including bank economists. Also, for instance, the economists of IDC were part of some of the meetings. And it started in November, we got the report in about June. So it was fairly extensive research. In the way that they looked at the consumer impact is that they disaggregated consumers in, just to interrupt myself, so you'll see there's some slight differences between these slides and the ones printed, but they are fairly small, and I'll give out the revised version later. It was just some cleaning up of last night. They looked at consumers in four categories. The group one is people earning below 1,800 rand a month. So it's really entry-level workers or very low-skilled workers. Group 2 is from 1,800 to 6,000 rand per month, then 6,000 to 17,000, and 17,000 above. In terms of the impact, they've looked at the potential for job losses, and they've correlated this potential for job losses with the potential for debt stress. Therefore, and in the stats you'll see that in the lowest income group, the likely impact of job losses are probably the highest. But they tend to not, these people tend not to be debt stressed. So there's a very real problem, but it's not a credit market problem. the second highest income and the highest income groups are probably the most stressed in terms of, because they are both at risk of job or income loss, and they are less stressed already. We are doing quite a bit more research, but I'm looking at the loss of income factors and the impact on SMEs. And if you just might put architecture later. That is, those are numbers that the researchers did based on the National Statistics Stats SA's data, Reserve Bank data, labor survey data. In terms of the, this is only one slide from a report that is fairly extensive, and we can give copies out for who is interested, is the, they disaggregated the impact by industry, and then for each industry subsector estimated, calculated the dependency of this industry sector on different regions of the world, for instance, which would then imply that an industry which exports primarily to the East, Far East, are more less likely to be negatively affected than an industry that exports primarily to Europe. Obviously also disaggregated industries that are heavily export dependent compared to an industry subsector that is mostly serving the domestic market. So all these were done in taking account in the calculation and come up with the overall numbers. What they've also done, I mean obviously it was very complicated to say now what are going to be the impact of the financial crisis. And is anybody that followed the newspapers would see that every second week you've got a different assessment of what's going on. So what we've asked them to do is to take a limited impact scenario and a severe impact scenario, and to look at these two differently and to see what answers come out. Both cases you will see that is the highest job losses is expected in that category two. The 6,000 to it's the 2,000 to 6,000 in income category. It's really your low wage workers or low middle wage workers. The second biggest impact is the people earning from 6,000 to 17,000. Let me just make one comment here on that reduction, the last bullet point on the slide. The point we're just raising here is that this work was mostly focused on job losses. But in the current environment, the biggest impact that we're actually seeing is not people necessarily losing their jobs, but people that have reduced income. For instance, people that are used to work a certain number of overtime hours, where the company say cut back on the overtime hours. That person's income that they used to is now less. People that work as estate agents, their income would be dramatically reduced. Anybody that's in any kind of sales capacity, whether it's salesperson, self, or anybody in that sales-oriented environment, people's income are reduced. All of us who get annual bonuses, those annual bonuses are probably going to affect the impact of the financial crisis. And South Africans have become very used to settling their credit cards with an annual bonus. So the point we're making here is that the impact of the financial crisis and of the economic downturn is actually much bigger than only job losses. And you find many, many families that are in a position, even though both partners may still be working, that their income could be 20 or 30% less than what they used to. And they are obviously finding it extremely difficult to reconcile this reduced income with their debt obligations. This really summarizes this whole set in the area that we see as the high-risk area is where people earning between 6,000 and 17,000. Because they both are high-risk of job losses and income reductions, and they are also highly indebted. More than that, their debt is included a lot of motor vehicle finance debt and mortgage debt. If I move back to category two, the people earning between 2,000 and 6,000, there's also fairly high debt levels, but it tends to be shorter term debt, microloans, furniture finance, store cards. To the extent that people in that category are cautious in their credit behavior and that they do not take on new debt over a relatively short period of time, 2 years, 2 to 3 years, you'll find that their debt position automatically improves. Because they get to the end of the furniture finance, they've made the last payment. And as long as they don't take a new furniture credit, their position immediately has actually improved. So you don't actually need that much of an external assistance. And if you look at the statistics that we get from the likes of Furniture Traders, African Bank, Capitec Bank, everybody that services the low income, that category, the 2 to 6,000, the arrears levels there, the defaults, are getting better every month. For the, and it's reflecting the extent to which the consumers are actually paying off existing debt and not taking new debt. The problem in group 3 is people have got mortgages and motor vehicles, and those do not adjust quickly. It takes a long time before even people are out of their debt stress position. The same is true for category 4. We can argue that about 17,000 rand a month is our more higher income people. However, once they're in a debt stress position, they can't get out of it easily without external assistance. It is true, and we have not got a separate slide on it, that the but it is true that the interest rate reductions from the Reserve Bank has helped. The problem is if somebody was impacted by a fairly significant reduction in income or by a job loss of a partner, you're talking about 10, 15, 20% potentially even income reduction, then the reduction of the repayment on your mortgage is not sufficient to upset, to offset this. So it does help, but it doesn't solve the problem. Good, I'm going to, now let me make one point more here. Actually, you must tell me if I'm taking too much time. I'm not halfway. The point we're making here, it's not an uncomplicated one. There in some categories, let me make Peter's big point first. There's a tendency to see debt counseling as a solution for all problems. But where people have lost income, if the income is reduced to zero, debt counseling can't help because there's no income to restructure. Second point, there's a tendency from credit providers that argue that says this person's got 2 mortgages or they've got 2 cars. Let them sell it. Yes, we generally that may well be the right answer. But if they sell them at a loss, that shortfall comes back to the person. So it does not resolve the problem. And that shortfalls come back until finally all those shortfalls are lying on the person's individual estate again against their mortgage. So it is not uncomplicated to resolve these stress positions. I think the big point we're making in this slide, which we're really making quite strongly, is that despite various indications in the public domain that says the position is improving, there are so much mixed signals that we are not convinced that we can simply take that for granted. Secondly, and the bigger point for us is to say that we think it's important to assess the worst case scenario and then plan for it. If we end up believing all these predictions that says next year we will all be out of the crisis, what, and we then spend as if that is the reality, what happens if it is not reality? Or what happens if after 2010 we have a decline? So we must, for us, our message to both government and to the consumers is be cautious. In the policy, I've already talked about the 3 policy interventions that we talk about. We are engaging fairly extensively with this NECLAC process, the government initiated process, in order to deal with a lot of these things. So they are on that table as well, and we are part of that process as well. Now I'm getting to the last section of my slides, which is really to talk about the role of debt counseling and the problems that are being faced in debt counseling now. The first conceptual issue here is, let me just illustrate it. We had a lot of engagement very recently with probably the leading debt counseling institution in the world, a British-based company called CCCS. And what was quite sobering or disheartening engaging with them is in the UK they've got at least, I think, 4 or more different legal mechanisms through which they can deal with debt stress. Normal personal bankruptcy, personal insolvency. They've got a quick bankruptcy, Peter will talk about it later, quick bankruptcy route. They've got, and then they've got something similar to, well, not quite the strategy, but the debt payment flow rearrangements. The problem in South Africa that we have is that we do not have sufficient personal bankruptcy mechanisms. It is not possible in South African law, particularly for people with relatively low incomes, to go and declare themselves insolvent so that the slates get cleaned and they can start again. It is, I mean, our laws are outdated, ineffective, and not applied in practice. There is still, as far as I understand, a general principle in our law that says if the credit provider cannot gain out of the bankruptcy, the sequestration, then it should not go ahead in law. Now that means we have no effective way to take somebody that is actually just totally obedient to say, we write off your debts, but you must sell the following, you must sell your assets, and over three or four years you can start again. It means that a lot of these problems are going to come into debt counseling, and debt counseling can't really deal with it. The implications for houses, I think, for the audience and people would know. I mean, the problem, therefore, that you're sitting is when people's incomes have been reduced. Now they're sitting for the next 5-10 years that they simply can't make their payments, and the position every month is getting worse. Which is why we, even now, are starting to hear increasing reports, I mean, case in KZN recently, of somebody that committed suicide. So it is getting more and more serious at the ground level where people are dealing with the stress of not having sufficient income to pay their debts and to look after their families. What has obviously also happened, which I think we do need to keep note of, is a big, is the level of incidences to which people who get social security grants and are using these grants to make their debt repayments, which means the social network that we in South Africa have in place is not being used for its purpose, but is being used for debt servicing, which is absolutely the wrong thing to do. Why are we in this? Why are people owing debt? Why are we in the mess? Let's be clear. Consumers have been living beyond their means. Consumers have been trying to keep up with other consumers who have got fancy cars, yet they didn't have the income. So consumers are beyond their means. But international stats, and I think our stats as well, says that for probably close to half the consumers, the problem was not that they were necessarily owing debt. The problem was an external factor, the financial crisis, a debt in the family, somebody that lost a job, and that they now have to get to grips with that. Credit providers are very quick to blame the recklessness of the consumers. But we all have lived through the pattern of credit sales and the credit push. These telephone-originated sales, call centers that convince people to take credit that they can't take. We were sitting in this committee in the months before the National Credit Act became effective, where credit drafters were absolutely pushing credit down people's throats. Now those chickens are coming home to roost. So the only point I'm making here is that it takes two to tango, and we have to deal with both sides of it, which means both parties must come to the party. Both parties must come to the party and solve the problem. The current environment with the financial crisis has obviously aggravated all of this. We are now sitting with an externally induced event that we have to get to grips with. But I do want to make the last small bullet there before I get to the big bold, is we're putting quite a bit of pressure on the banks, and we'll get to some of that just now. But we also must recognize the pressure that the banks' own staff are under. In the good days, when the whole world was living on credit, the retail sections of the banks were making money hand over fist. They were just selling credit, they had huge profits. Now a lot of those debts are going into arrears. Their targets are now trying to get them to still sell some credit, push debt collection, try to recover, and do debt counseling. So a lot of these middle management level in the banks, they are under huge pressure, which is why some of the, at the operation level, some of these things start going on. In the final analysis on this type of topic, for us as NCR, our own position is that they say it takes credit providers and debt counselors and consumers to work together. We find many cases where consumers simply are refusing to sell their assets, even though they are already dead. Just to unpack, just to spend one moment at the slide, this is real cases, every one of those are real cases, and I have a slide with like five times as many cases, but it's too small to read. But you can see auditors, medical doctors, bank employees, property traders. To pick up one or two of them, if you look at the property trader, that guy has 22 million rand of debt. He's a person located in Mamelodi. He is not actually debtors, by the way. He bought properties in the beginning countries, which he had tenancy. The problem is when the interest rate started going up, he couldn't put his rentals up. Then when cost of living went up, people started even vacating these properties. So his business collapsed. So it is not, you can't blame either the bank. They might have lent a bit too much. Although the guy had a business. That was his business, was buying his property. So the medical doctor, you can make a similar statement about. The guy set up a practice at a price which ended up being not viable for him to have a practice. So it collapsed. But then look at the nurse. I can't remember. Peter can talk about the detail, but this person has no income. So you cannot assist that person through debt counseling because there's nothing to restructure. That is, would have been a tactical case for some kind of personal insolvency mechanism. When we look at debt counseling currently, 1,200 debt counselors are already registered. There's an aggregate of 116,000 applications for debt counseling. Only around 6,000 of these have gone through the legal process. From the 116,000, only about 6,000 has gone through. However, there's also quite a number of cases where people voluntarily withdrew from the case, or they just lost heart, they're not participating anymore. Or alternatively, they went to the credit provider and they came with some informal settlement, but they've not withdrawn from the case. However, our estimate is that the real backlog is in the order of 70,000 cases that are waiting there for resolution and not getting resolved. And that 70,000 are increasing in the order of 9,000 per month. It is a problem. If you looked at our presentation, I think the last one we did here about 6 months ago, those numbers were all about a third of this. The problem is getting more and more serious every month. But there is a positive reflection here. Even with all the problems that I'll get into now, already as we sit here, just more, 170 million rand per month is being distributed to credit providers from the debt counseling process. 107 million per month. So there's distributions by every month is increasing. So the process can work if we can get the legal issues to be resolved. I think I'm going to skip this, but this slide summarizes all the various areas where the NCR has intervened to try to make debt counseling work, from training to debt counselors, to payment distribution agencies, to our own call center. We've got a specialized section on the call center that deals only with debt stress cases. The University of Pretoria report that we've mandated, so maybe we can get to these in the questions if we get there. Why do we have these problems? Why do we sit with these backlogs? Some of my friends in the banking sector don't like it if I say it. But the truth is that the banks in particular exploited the fact that the Act is new, that there's some of the areas of the Act that is uncertain on interpretation, by opposing each and every case when it got to the Magistrates Court. Arguments that says it is out of jurisdictions, arguments that says the monetary limit is to be, and so forth and so forth, which meant the cases could not get through the court system, which is why we are sitting with these increasing backlogs. But I have to also recognize that they, in the recent months, there's been fairly big movement on the banking side. So we're starting to see the signs of improvement. Also to say that they, in those cases where we deal with individual banks, where we find that things that's wrong, where we confront with them, we get a very good response. And not to come up with them too much here, but I think we should not underestimate, apart from all these 70,000 backdrop, in reality, there are thousands more cases that has been dealt with, that has been informally resolved by the banks themselves, between them and their clients. Fundamentally, as a result of the National Credit Act, because they were trying to avoid their clients going under the debt counseling, so they've got an incentive now to actually to come with a settlement. So there are a great many people whose houses have already been saved due to the extent of the act, despite the problems of debt counseling. And let's also recognize there are lots of problems on debt counselors. Of the 1,200 that we have registered, we think a good number of them need to be deregistered. People who are taking debt counseling cases and doing nothing. We had a case like that at the tribunal recently. Cases where debt counselors are not following the timelines. Cases where debt counselors take these applications from our vulnerable consumers and overcharge them. But it is a new process. I mean, that's what everybody that have been in this kind of process before tells us all the time. It's a new law, it takes time. The problem, obviously, is that we're sitting with a financial crisis now, so we don't really have time. The NCR is... Two slides. You might have seen that we've gone to the High Court. We also already went about a year and a half ago for an application for declaratory order at the High Court. The intention was that through this declaratory order to get clarity on these, on the interpretation of these issues which have been used as reasons for opposing the cases from taking place. The declaratory order has been announced, it came through on the 21st of August. It has assisted in a whole number of cases. It clarified the jurisdiction, which magistrates court has jurisdiction. It clarified that the 100,000 magistrates court limit doesn't apply. It clarified the process. It created clarity in a number of areas. However, it also created certain problems and left a number of problems unresolved. I'll unpack some of this just now. Also just to note that the declaratory order or certain sections of it is being appealed by one debt counselor and by about four banks. So even the solution that we have now is a solution that is still not the final solution. The reality then being that despite the declaratory order, we have critical problems that must be addressed and that can only be addressed either through amendments to the Act or through regulations, well, in fact, probably. Just to go quickly to give you an idea of what they are, the document delivery, in terms of the magistrate's court, this could become too detailed, but the declaratory order say that if the credit provider agree, documents can be delivered by fax, but if he doesn't, then he will have to have the sheriff in the court process. That is an expensive and time-consuming process. The process of the hearing, the clarity order determined that it is the magistrate's court process, I think per Rule 55, that will apply. It is a long and cumbersome and extensive process. The status of the hearing, the clarity order said that it is the debt counselor that brings the application and not the consumer. It actually creates legal problems. The most significant issue probably that has been not been addressed in the declaratory order is two. The one is that if you read section 129 of the Act, it says the way that it's interpreted is that if the section 129 notice is issued for enforcement action, many credit providers and some judges are arguing that the person can't go to a debt counselor anymore. That would defeat the purpose of the Act in totality. And the last but not least is that there is partly uncertainty and partly real limitations in the act in terms of the magistrate's court's ability to reduce debt and to reduce interest payments, which means you're sitting with this position now that the only way that can be adjusted, only thing that can be adjusted is the payment term. Now that ends up being in many cases that you get to arrangements that are something. In many, many cases, you cannot resolve the case of debtors if you can't reduce the interest rate and you can't reduce the total amount owed. The tribunal enforcement provisions, I won't talk too much about them now, but Diane will talk about them a lot more later. But the problem is our act is very, very limiting on what the tribunal can do, which means the tribunal's ability to deal with debt counseling cases is probably excessively limited. In terms of the debt counseling process itself, you see a long list of things, each of which, the point I'm trying to make is that even after the declaratory order, all of those problems still remain. I'll skip this because I need a couple of examples. Currently, the Act creates the impression that when somebody goes to a debt counselor, they must continue making their payments to all the creditors. But the point is, they go to a debt counselor because they can't make their payments. So it is actually not possible for them to continue making their payments, which in theory now creates the legal possibility that the credit provider say, well, you should have continued making your payments under reforce. So that needs to be clarified. The payment, the fees that a debt counselor can charge is not properly regulated now. That whole section must be revised, as well as the fees about payment distribution. The treatment of secured debts against unsecured debts. I mean, currently, there's no clarity on how the debt counselor must treat the mortgage compared to the unsecured microloan, and they, in many cases, are treated equally, which is probably completely inappropriate and undermines the mortgage holder's rights excessively. All of these are actually important, but let me do the last one at least, is there is no clarity currently for rehabilitation. So you in theory sit with a theoretical possibility that a consumer goes under debt counseling, that they've got a mortgage, and they in theory could now remain under debt counseling after the mortgage is repaid 15 years later. They also, these are all things that we would, when we read the Act, we say, well, there should be a possibility to resolve it even at the Act stage. But it leaves us with a problem that the Act as it is now is not definitive enough. And once the Act is not definitive enough, you're allowing too much possibilities for all the parties to create legal disputes, which blocks the process. And the last slide is just to say that every indication, all the work that we've done tells us the National Credit Act had absolutely its intended purposes. It was timely, it did the right things, it curbed credit when it should have curbed credit. The debt counseling process, despite all these problems, are already assisting a lot of people. And even more so, the extent to which banks are trying to find settlements which otherwise they may never have done. Otherwise, they may have simply repossessed. But the fallout from the financial crisis is increasing. We do not think that this is just going to take off. We think the numbers may well continue increasing, and in particular, there where somebody is over-indebted on mortgages or motor vehicles, the income is reduced, they've got some kind of arrangement with their employers, they are not able to meet their repayments, and they get more and more of them going to fall off. And I think I spoke already about the policy responses, so we can get back to that, to the questions. Thank you, Chair. Sorry for starting.
All right, members, I think that this presentation was very simple and straightforward and very heartening at the same time very threatening. But I think that it is our task now that to engage with this report. I think that what we have to do, we have about 30 minutes to go to 11. So what I'll appreciate is that if each and every member can ask 3 questions at a time, not beyond that, so that we can give other members a chance. But I can see that the 2, 4, 6, well, about 8 people here. So if it is 3-ish, it will be fine. And that's because we're running a little bit behind time. I didn't say the members must introduce themselves as the delegation was introducing itself. I request that, as I point out, you introduce yourself so that the delegation can know you and know your name. So I saw the first hand of Professor Turo.
Next.
Thank you very much. Chair, an excellent presentation, and we know the institution very well. They've done marvelous work. Before I go into a question and some comments, I just said I think there's an error in the language of increasing lending. What you really mean is increasing borrowing. Am I right? On that one table. Unfortunately, your stuff is not page numbered. But that one big table, you say increased lending by the doctor. What you mean is ex-employee of the bank. Am I right? Anyway, you can come back to me. I think you mean borrowing. Also, the credit agreements by the ex-employee of the bank, and indeed all those people, is amazing. These people have 19 agreements. It's incredible. Chair, this is our act. This committee spent a lot of time on this in the past. And therefore, it's our responsibility to defend it. And the question I have is, I want to make a few comments, but the question I have is this. Since the banks fought back on every case, should this committee call in the banks and ask them why they obstructed the implementation of this act? Because it's our act, and it's our responsibility. So even though you say later on that the banks have cooperated here and there, I wonder whether it shouldn't be our responsibility to say to the banks, come and explain. So that's a question for you. The points I want to make is this. It's quite clear that there's excessive consumption in the economy, particularly conspicuous consumption around cars and houses by the middle and upper class. And it seems to me, Chair, that this committee ought to say something about that. If the culture in South Africa has become one of conspicuous consumption and reckless borrowing by the middle and upper income people, then I think Parliament should say something about that. It's not just for the President to make moralistic statements about consumerism. Parliament must say something. So that's my second point. The third point I want to make is a very fundamental one for this committee. We have been told here that in the modern period, the service sector is a very important growth sector. And it is indeed. It creates a lot of jobs and so on. Insurance, property marketing, all that, the service sector. But the service sector, as we see internationally, is the most vulnerable when there's economic crisis, as this data shows. So this committee, which is trade and industry, which has to make judgments about economic policy all the time, we have to make a judgment when people come here and say to us, don't worry about manufacturing, don't worry so much about industrial policy, the service sector is going to boost the economy. Well, we see worldwide that the first industry to collapse is the service sector, including banks, in the United States, Europe, and so on. So that point is very important for our committee and our policy interventions. The last point is actually a bit of a question. If consumers are in debt, there's an impact on that. You see, Chair, very often we talk about who pays tax in South Africa, and we usually point to the rich and the middle-income people and companies. But 26% of debt collection in South Africa, which is a third of all the collection, is by VAT, which is the consumer. So I want to ask our friend here, have you done any work on the consequences of the fall in consumer action on tax income for revenue? Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you, Professor Turok. I'll go to Mr. Panavis David, and then followed by Mr. Marek.
Thank you,
Ms. Chair. Ms. Kumar.
Chair, thank you. From my side as well,
to Mr. Dahl before his presentation, I think the whole issue of credit is extremely important. And earlier in this term of Parliament, I've learned that we can act very swiftly if we need to change legislation. That was around the whole issue of the lotteries. Now, I think the issue of credit is much more important and has a far greater impact than that of the lotteries. So my question to Mr. Dahl is, he has said that there are a lot of uncertainty regarding the Act. And when we were first introduced in July at the DTI, he highlighted a few of those aspects. And I thought with the court giving judgment in August of this year that much of that would have been cleared. It seems now as if the banks have gone on appeal. Now, these things can drag on forever. And my question to Mr. Dahl is, how much of that can we try and avoid by amending the legislation, stating certain things more clearly, perhaps even giving our approval to certain regulations and so on. And if I remember correctly, he actually made such an appeal to us. But how can we assist him, and how can he assist us by perhaps paving the way to get many of these court cases and uncertainties out of the way as quickly as possible? If you could respond to that, I would appreciate it.
Right, Mr. Moran. Thank you, Chair. There's a few points. The first one is also on banks and the role of banks. And I will support, us calling the banks to also appear before us. There is in terms of the BEE charters, there's an obligation on banks to become involved with BEE transactions. But in my opinion, there's no contribution as such, because they're purely lending money for BEE transactions, taking no extra risk, no lower margins, so they're actually not contributing anything. And they're still looking at the same credit requirements whatsoever. And obviously they claim that the National Credit Act prohibits them from basically doing that. So first of all, to what extent can the National Credit Regulator create opportunities for banks to support BEE transactions further. In terms of granting credit to consumers, I've heard so many times of people complaining that banks are just blaming the National Credit Act for not granting credit, where otherwise it would have been granted, and as you've rightfully said in the past, they are irresponsible, on an irresponsible way, or just pushed for credit grants to consumers. So what can and obviously if they can indicate to us where banks are actually faulting and actually claiming wrongfully that the National Credit Act is providing is prohibiting them from doing that. In the past it was claimed that our economic growth was demand driven. And it's true, it was demand-driven. And obviously credit played a huge role in that demand-driven economic growth. Then everybody sat back and said, no, we need a more balanced economic growth, so you need a supply side that must respond as well. Now you're faced with a position that the supply side of the economy wants to stimulate and wants to support, but there's no consumer response to that. Now everybody says, consumers need to spend more to get the economic growth on the way. But that implies granting credit. So you sit with the conflicting messages coming out, and then again the National Credit Regulator comes into play, and the National Credit Act. So it seems like it's adding to this confusion. How do we need to stimulate economic growth? A very important point that I want clarity from the National Credit Regulator is the role of credit bureaus. I've had so many people complaining to me of
the cooperation, or let me rather say the lack of cooperation from credit bureaus, where there will be old judgments, old default payments, and despite the understanding, at least from my side, in terms of, you know, that credit bureau should after a period should wipe that, and obviously because of, I mean, we all know that the financial crisis and how that added to that, it seems like it doesn't appear as on the credit record, but there's a history that still implicates on the people's ability to borrow money. You know, in my opinion, that is unfair that credit bureaus still will give a bad credit record based on what happened in the past, even before that was written off. Now that is not, in my opinion, contributing to economic growth in the future. And then my last point on debt counselling. And I think why so many people are reluctant to go for debt counselling is the moment that you go for debt counselling, it obviously affects your credit record. And some people would say, you know, it is so important to rather earlier than later becomes involved with debt counselling. But, you know, again, when they become involved with debt counselling, it's an inscription on their credit record. So they rather stay away and see whether one can resolve it without affecting their credit record badly. And that is something that credit regulators should respond as well constructively on how we can build together a sort of environment that we can move forward, which currently is so conflicting and is so confusing. Thank you very much.
Right, thank you. Ms. Kumar.
The colleague, my colleague that recently spoke, it's like he was in my mind as well, around the issue of credit bureau as well as the issue of a debt counselor. However, I have to ask this question to say on slide 14, group 4, there is a risk of job loss, which is very low, but there is also a risk of income that is low. My question on that, around that, what is the cause? Because I might have missed the explanation where why the presenter was giving the presentation. Two, is that how safe for an individual to go out and declare him or herself being bankrupt and it affects the credit weight for future records. The last one will be the one for the debt counselor. What is the response? Are the people happy enough just go voluntarily there and it is affecting the credit rate as well if they voluntarily go there for being counseling for debt and it affects their record if in future they have to do any credit? Thanks, sir.
All right, thank you, Ms. Kumar. I go to Mr. Pawar and then I start to understand Shigana.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to find out how long does it take for the consumer to be removed from the records of the credit regulator after the debt has been paid out?
From what? From the credit
regulator? From the credit regulator.
All right.
From the records of the credit regulator. And secondly, does the consumer have to apply, or is it the debt counselor who applies on behalf of the consumer for the removal? And linked to that, if there is no application either from the consumer or the debt counselor, how long does it take for the regulator to remove that person automatically because the debt has been paid off? Thank you.
behalf of my colleagues, illustrated the presentation by NDR. Every time I drive to Pretoria, past their building, I feel so cute, I feel like popping in. But unfortunately, I'm always rushing for a meeting. Credit must be given where it's necessary. Not financial credit now. The first area is I didn't pick up the last fourth or third slide, which raises the, if I use the little term, the lacuna. So I hope that Mr. Rosa could be worked out. I'm not sure that it's in the package. But my question is just one that what you see as the impact of this on microfinance lending? I know it may be outside your area, but recently we had some of here and they made some comments around the impact and implications of debt stress. It might be helpful to see if there are linkages between the two. Around debt counseling, what is SBR's assessment of the level of public understanding on debt counseling linked to the third one, Chair said, Mr. 3? I see the ratio of debt counselors to the number of who have credit or who maybe having the risk has been rather extremely high. Now, is there any program strategy on massification of debt counselors, or would it be the appropriate route to take to have more debt counselors in order to help consumers at large? Thank you very much, Chair.
All right, Mr. Mabasa.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. What I wanted to ask is for people to be listed under the credit bureau, can the credit bureau list them just on the basis of getting evidence and information from the one party? Or does it mean that the credit bureau must wait for an engagement between the parties so that by the time it lists a person, it has the benefits of information from both parties? And then number two, can the credit bureau be wrong? Is it ever wrong? Does it ever list people wrongly? And can it be sued as a credit bureau? But if we go to the person, the credit provider, can a credit, is it possible that people who have entered into a transaction, is it possible that there are under certain circumstances they may not exit from the contract? And if it is so, what are the conditions under which people may not exit from a contract? And under what conditions can they exit from the contract? Thanks.
All right. Thank you, member. I think that we are having about 24 questions. Which is directed to the NCR. So I thought that when I said it must be 3, I thought that we'll have another round. But I think that 11 is around the corner where we must have our tea break. But you can do your best, because I also had some questions, but what is interesting is 30 around our trading, the issue of debt cancellers versus the people who are the credit consumers. 1,200 and something, and then the credit consumers 17 million. Will these people ever be able to deal with those people? I think that one must be clarified. Thank you. Can you respond? Mustard or Peter?
Thank you, Chair. I will deal with some of the questions and I'll be able to deal with some. There's quite a few as I can see. So let's just to start with the comment made by Honorable Professor Turo about possibility of calling them to the committee so that they can come and explain. Our view certainly is that the committee is we are saying certainly that the committee is prerogative to call the banks, and I think Parliament has done that very well with other sectors. However, my suggestion would always be that it might be also useful in the event banks are actually being called, it might be useful to also get debt counselors also to come to address the committee so that the committee can get the balance. And another question that I'll deal with is the next one relates to the credible one. There was an issue around people going into debt cancelling and the fact that it affects your record. Rather clear we and what is the NCR's viewpoint, but if you look at the Act specifically indicates that if somebody applies for debt cancelling, the consumer applies for debt cancelling, he or she may not get any further or additional credit. So it is by design that once you are under debt cancelling, you should not join the credit. However, once you have been rehabilitated as a consumer, a debt counselor would issue what we call a clearance certificate of some sort, meaning you are no longer over indebted, so which means that record would actually be cleared of the credit bureau records. The same applies to negative listings with the credit bureaus. The Act has got elaborate provisions on credit bureaus. As you know now, credit bureaus are regulated, and their retention period provided in the Act, for example, special information pertaining to their payment profile, the maximum permissible period that they can hold the information is 5 years. On, for example, inquiries, it's 2 years. And the list is on, it goes on and on like that. Adverse classification of the enforcement action, 2 years. Specifically, when it relates to judgment, it's 5 years or until the judgment is actually rescinded from the court. So, meaning if there was judgment recorded, I think, your name on the credit bureau, after 5 years, such information must be taken out. Alternatively, you can actually rescind such information so that it's taken off the credit bureau records. Most importantly, if there is accurate information with the credit bureau, you have the credit information ombuds, which can actually deal with such matters. If you are not satisfied, we have the NCR, we deal with such matters from time to time. Service protection period, level of public understanding on debt counselors. Obviously, the Act is fairly new. From our side of the NCR, we're doing quite a bit in terms of creating awareness on the Act and specifically on the debt cancelling provisions on the Act. But as Gabriel has indicated, to date we've seen in excess of 100,000 consumers actually approaching debt cancellors. So that's quite significant. And we've seen on average around between 9 and 10,000 consumers approaching debt cancellors per year. The expectation is, even when we do more awareness creation and education, people will begin to understand what debt cancelling means for them, what are the implications, because one of the things that we are emphasizing is
first and foremost, when you start experiencing problems as a consumer, consumers should generally go and discuss their problems with their credit providers, and in particular their banks. I think we've got enough number of debt counselors. 1,200, they are able to deal with the cases that get referred to them. I think what's challenging at the moment is some challenges that Gabriel has dealt with in his presentation, which needs amendments, of course. I'll leave some of the questions to Gabriel and pick up on those that we shall have raised.
Economic growth levels fueled by credit that we are now, it is very similar to somebody that stopped smoking or somebody that stopped using drugs, that we are finding exceedingly, and I think logically, I mean, like the drug user that you withdraw the drugs from, and he struggles, our economy is struggling because we've been used to that. The bottom hand slide there shows you the house price index, where the whole country went into a state of panic because house price decline, but if you look at how moderate the decline actually was after the bottom slide there, after so many years of absolutely extraordinary growth, if the adjustment is necessary, it quite a few of the question gets to the same issue about lending or not lending. Let me get to that right now. Is that On the one hand, it is very obvious, and I think we've all seen many cases where lending has been done that simply should not have been done, which then simply had to lead to default. It probably eventually will lead to a court action. So all that the National Credit Act is trying to do is to say that if you've done a loan and the consumer eventually default, and you go to the magistrate and you say, "Dear magistrate, I need a court order," then the magistrate should ask you, show me the record of this consumer when you did the loan. Was the consumer, if the consumer was already owing debt, then you can't get a court order. That surely is a logical and reasonable limitation. We fully agree. I mean, we have seen many cases as well as of banks using the National Credit Act as an excuse for not lending. The reality, I mean, our position is very clear. If based on your loan, you do not have a reasonable expectation that the consumer can repay his loan, then you cannot lend. And if we find you lending, you will not be able to get a quarter, and we will prosecute you as well if we have to intervene. On the other hand, if we look at the extent to which credit has declined, it does appear as if there's been an overreaction. That even people who should have the ability to make repayments are also getting declined. And that is the real problem. Another component in terms of, we did not look at the impact on that of all these issues, but what we have looked at a little bit and we are quite concerned about is the extent to which, due to over-indebtedness, people cannot make payments, in particular at municipal service payments. If we look at any of the big areas, I mean, you talk about billions of rand into arrears. Those same consumers are probably making their debt payments, but we are bankrupting our municipal service sector by the extent to which we have extended credit in the country. And if we have to get that balance right, and we will only get that balance right with effective penalties against excessive lending. How many of these problems can be addressed through amendments to the Act? The things that I listed, this was an extra slide since last night's production, is these are very real problems. These problems that we've summarized here will not go away until we have amendments. We have made a submission to Department of Trade and Industry. from what I understand, I mean, the assurance we got is that they are working on this, and that it is likely, our understanding is that the court row, the parliamentary row for this year is full, but that it will hopefully be submitted early next year. But the problems will not go away until these things are addressed. We are making progress in engaging with the banks, in banks agreeing not to oppose certain aid cases. But that is, you cannot avoid a legal weakness by a voluntary arrangement. The legal weakness is remaining. And some of these we cannot address through any kind of voluntary arrangement. Things like the magistrate's power to reduce interest rates or to reduce debts. If the magistrate doesn't have that power, he can't exercise it, whatever we want to agree with anybody. The question about lending criteria, DEV lending, as NCR and the NCA as well, we are outside of the lending decision when we think it is appropriate. I mean, it is for the bank to decide when they want to lend and when they do not want to lend, and to apply commercial grounds. And I think that is an appropriate way to be. Because the moment as the state or as the public sector we start intervening to say, you should do more lending, you actually create a basis for the credit granted, the banks to come back to Parliament to say, you told us to lend. Now we've got a default, who's going to pay for the default? You know, the banks at various stages come to ask the NCR to say, you must give us guidelines for reckless credit. We don't want to actually do that, because our position is that if you want to be a banker, the only reason for being a banker is to make the decision on when to lend and not when to lend. It is not for government to tell you when to lend and when not to lend. And you take that risk, and you must live with the consequences. Credit bureaus, there was a couple of questions that dealing with the Mrs. Kumalu, amongst others, on the impact of the penalties from going under debt counseling, the penalties for being declared bankrupt. I think it is a logical consequence of the reality is if a consumer went owing debt, the consumer now requires that the credit provider must do a write-off. It is a reasonable outcome of the law that consumer must carry the penalty. And in the debt counseling clauses, the penalty is that as long as you are only indebted, as long as you are under debt counseling, you are not allowed to borrow again. Which again, I would argue is a reasonable consequence, because this particular consumer let's forget the financial crisis, because that is very extraordinary circumstances, but even in the financial crisis, this consumer is in a position where he or she cannot make the debt repayments. To argue that this consumer must now take further debt would be completely undermine the whole process. In terms of how long does this penalty impact, and we must always, it's Mr. Ntsikulani that asked us a question that resorted us to our Bible here, section, when you go into debt counseling, you remain listed, and the prohibition remains against more borrowing, more lending, remain in place until you've paid off your debts. You've been issued a clearance certificate. Once the clearance certificate is issued, the clearance certificate must be given to the credit bureau. The credit bureau must then expunge from your record any reference to the fact that you were indebted, that you were in debt counseling, or the fact that you were owing debt. So the prize for the reward for the consumer who has gone through the painful process of debt counseling is that at the end of this process, his or her record will be clean. But you can only get there if you actually went to repay all your debts. I mean, if we were to soften that impact, we could be, I think, very, very negative. If it is possible for consumers to get over indebted, to get debt forgiveness, and then to start borrowing again, that is what everybody will do. It's because it is like being able to go and gamble but never to lose. that section, by the way, section 71, sub 5, impact on microfinance, I mean, our position would still be the same. If the microfinancier's client is over-indebted, there's no way that the microfinancier can argue that he or she must be able to do another loan and be able to still enforce the credit. I mean, if this person is over-indebted, what must they, how will they claim the next loan? I would very much agree with Peter's position, as he says already. The problem is not the number of debt counsellors. In fact, the number of debt counsellors that we have now is probably sufficient to deal with the number of applications that we have. The problem are the backlogs, is that they get the cases in and they're not able to finalise them. So the cases there, in their own offices, they've got an increasing huge backlog, which means they can't finalise them. The additional point would be that if the legal system were working, if these cases will get to the courts and some of the credit provider is being declared reckless there, the moment that the court system work, the signals, the messages will go back to the credit providers. And they will know that if they do the following type of loan, they're probably going to be declared reckless later, they better should stop giving. Or that if in a particular circumstances the client comes to them in and this client is X percent indebted, that if this were to get to a court, the court is likely to find whatever answer, and that they will come with a settlement before the time. But until the court system works, the system is just stopped. Everybody should wait. Peter, I think
I've covered everything. All right. Thank you for the eloquent way you have responded to this. Although there are certain things which you have just asked, but I think that the Secretary will send you all the questions you didn't respond to. Take example, just like the input of Honorable Turo about the impact of this thing on the collection of VAT. I think that one must be a study which might commission later. And then the issue of the consumer, the credit bureau, Mr. Mabasa asked a specific question. Do they ever make any mistakes? If they've made mistakes, are they going to be suable? I think those are the questions you are asking. Even though they're part of the education campaign, are the education campaigns reaching the rural areas? Do you have a strategy of reaching the rural areas, or do we only concentrate on the cities? Yeah. And then the issue of all right, the backlog we indicated as 70,000 here. Will these people, apart from this court process you're speaking about, are these people really going to be able to get backlog if it's already 70,000 at this point? Can that be the people?
If the rural education book, Peter, if you don't mind this speciality, are the bureaus, they most definitely do make mistakes. But let's note that when the Act came in, something in the order of 6 million consumers had the benefit of data being removed. That was in the first year of the Act. So there's a huge number of old and incorrect data was removed. Small judgments were all removed. Largely the data that's on the Bureau now are newer data. You do find mistakes, but at least, I mean, if a consumer, beyond that, the consumer can for free get a copy of his or her own record. So the way to address incorrect information is for the consumer to get a copy of the record, to challenge this as a credit information onward, or with us if they can't get right there, and then legally we can force that they can get removed. The bureaus can be sued, we can also prosecute them, and we've already taken legal action on one of the bureaus when there was inaccuracy. And just for the record, I mean, during the first year of the Act, that was 2007, we had a huge strategy focusing on credit bureaus. So actually, on credit bureaus, the level of conduct has much improved. So generally the issues, but there are always specifics that may still need. Against the rule.
Thank you, Chair. We do quite a lot in terms of awareness creation and education at the NCR. We also do impact assessment just to see if our interventions are reaching out the stated objectives. We
had a lot of exposure that we get through both national radio and community radio stations. Also workshops, particularly in the rural areas. We tend to work with traditional authorities. We've got dedicated officials whose function is really to go out to these far and outlying areas. And they do such workshops in conjunction with organs of civil society. We even have steps in terms of how many workshops, of the workshops that we've conducted, how many have been conducted in the rural areas. So we track that. One of the impact assessment studies that we did a year ago, among others, pointed out that we need to do more in rural areas. And that's exactly the area. Those are some of the areas that we are currently focusing on. Although we tend to go to all the areas, because as you know, creating impact on everyone in the country. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I think that you are reached a point of around 7 o'clock. It's sort of past 7 o'clock now. Are there any members who have a single question to ask? If there's anything, please, let us not create unnecessary. All right, Mr. Njikelane, Mr. Mabaso, Prophet.
Chair, to me, another question, just to ensure that we as a community, we firmly commit ourselves to prepare for the legislative review. I dare say that we need to also be proactive ourselves and start, you know, commissioning research and things independently. My motivation on that is that the credit or the credit industry does have a huge impact on economic transformation in general and economic growth in particular. I mean, you chair the testing one way or another, not whether you or your friend has had some grassroots credit. So it's very fundamental. That's why I was deliberately even raising the question of micro lending, because we a couple of days ago we had, you know, a very good exposure of that. Number two is the public hearings, and I hope it will present that to our chair Honorable Fab as well, that we need to craft a very creative program on public hearings, but link it to the legislative review. To me, it's not that just the bank, it's actually the whole community of credit providers, you know, because the reference is also made here to, you know, to vehicles. Now, vehicle financing at times is not necessarily through banks, but also the retail sector does have a very, very significant role to play when it comes to that. Probably just my humble suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Question
I had asked to say, if I have got into a credit, is it not possible to exit from the credit if I have a valid reason? But then the second one is the credit bureau not obliged to get views from both parties before they list the person?
On the credit contract, there are termination clauses from both sides, but they will obviously be subject to the consumer paying the outstanding amounts. Alternatively, if an asset was purchased on credit, you know, allowing the credit provider to repossess the asset and sell it and then to settle the shortfall. So in credit at least, it will always be subject to a settlement having been reached. So this consumer at least had received an amount upfront. In terms of on the credit bureaus, the way the system works is that the information which the credit bureau loads onto the record is information that they receive from the credit provider, the banks or the retailers or anybody. There's a requirement on the credit provider that before they list somebody, that they must send a notice to the consumer that say, "Dear Mr. XYZ, you are in arrears. If you do not pay up within so many days, then we will send a message to the credit bureau that say that list you as a late payer." So that is where the information must come. So there's no negotiation process. We must also recognize that there's something like 4 million odd records that go, information pieces that go into the credit bureaus, and that the credit bureau, it's critical that we keep them updated. Otherwise, if that information is not there, it is, we are creating a position where over-indebtedness will be more and more general, because lenders will just not know who is over-indebted. So the system really is that somebody must get the notification up front, the information goes to the credit bureau, they can get this free record, and if they are challenging any information that's incorrect, they can lodge a dispute. The dispute clauses in our Act is probably more dramatic than most other laws that I'm aware of, because if the credit bureau receives the dispute, they immediately have to remove that information until they've investigated the dispute, and then they can either return it to the record if it is correct, or they must keep it deleted permanently if they can't find evidence. So the system works so that rather than upfront consultation, at the back end there's sufficient mechanisms, I think, to deal with any potential incorrect information.
All right, no, thanks a lot for the session. I think that now the time is around quarter past 11. We can go for a tea break for about 15 minutes, come back at half past, and then we have the presence from the tribunal. Thank you for the input you have made. I think you clarified a lot of things.
The court of law giving us problems concerning the issue of the credit issues. I think that the press would choose, or better things, about the workings of the tribunal. So, who's going to present the chairperson? So, I'll just give the chairperson of the consumer tribunal, Ms. Diane Serblanche, to take us through her presentation. And then, what we'll do this time, because we still have a little bit of time, we'll give her about 40 minutes to do the work. And then we'll give the MPs about the remainder from 10 past to 1 o'clock. It means that the MPs get about 50 minutes because they've got the money from the people on the ground and so they must speak more. It's their work to speak. All right. Can fire on.
Acting Chairperson, Honourable Member Hadebe, members, honourable members of the Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry, it's an honour and a pleasure for us to be here today to talk about the work and the role of the National Consumer Tribunal in the current economic crisis and the situation many consumers find themselves in. I am going to ask at the outset, on the outset, your indulgence on two respects. The one is that I'm not going to take the honourable members or anybody present here through the objectives of the National Credit Act. Gabriel has done that very competently in his presentation, and those objectives are similarly applicable to the National Consumer Tribunal. In terms of the presentation, we have basically structured it along two specific sections. The first section is going to take you through the tribunal and its role, how it is constituted, what it does, and so on. And in that respect, I'm asking for your indulgence in case you have been put through a presentation like this in the past. We are never quite sure whether we shouldn't just recontextualize where the National Consumer Tribunal fits into the whole area of credit regulation in South Africa today. So we defaulted on the basis of just repeating those basic aspects. The National Consumer Tribunal was, of course, established in terms of Section 26 of the National Credit Act, Act 34 of 2005, and it has jurisdiction throughout South Africa. It is very important for us to mention at the outset the fact of its very wide jurisdiction. The reason for that is that then that means that we are not limited in the type of interventions that we can make on behalf of consumers or any parties under the National Credit Act, as is, for example, the Magistrates Court. It means that we can hear a matter irrespective of where the contract was signed or where the parties reside in South Africa. That obviously makes it very easy for us to deal with a wide spectrum of matters. In response to what's been happening in the adjudicative domain around the courts, that is really what caused the legislature yourself, amongst others, to create a tribunal such as the National Consumer Tribunal. And we are taking our mandate from the legislature and yourself very seriously in respect of our processes, in respect of being accessible to everybody who is entitled to the adjudicating services we provide, in terms of being informal and moreover in terms of being fair and acting in accordance with the principles of natural justice. In that respect, specifically to be seen to do and act fairly and not to be biased towards any party who appears before the tribunal. Just briefly on the functions of the Consumer Tribunal. We are an adjudicative body. We operate as an adjudicative entity. People, consumers, credit providers, credit bureaus, debt counselors, the credit regulator, and from next year also the Consumer Commission comes to us as a last resort. They will first try and resolve issues through alternative dispute resolution, and then they can come to us on specific matters provided for in the National Credit Act and in terms of the National Consumer Protection Act, which will be coming into operation on 24 October 2010, and of course with a commission that's going to be created by 24 April of 2010. And our role will accordingly be expanded to deal with those issues. In terms of the processes that are followed by the National Consumer Tribunal, how we handle our cases is regulated in terms of our rules of conduct for proceedings before the tribunal, and that was promulgated in the Government Gazette of August 2007, and we actually started hearing cases in August 2007 upon the promulgation of our specific rules. The effect of the orders of the tribunal is that it has the same effect as an order issued by the High Court in terms of Section 152(1) of the National Credit Act. And similarly, it will have the same impact or effect under the National Consumer Protection Act. That means that if an order of the tribunal is not adhered to, that it amounts to contempt of court and can lead to criminal prosecution and sanction. The tribunal orders are binding on all the parties who come before the tribunal, and it is also binding on the magistrates' courts. It's also binding on a high court when it relates to a determination of prohibited practice that was made by the National Consumer Tribunal. We have a whole menu of orders that we may issue in terms of both the National Credit Act and the Consumer Protection Act. Very importantly, we can declare conduct prohibited, i.e. that there's a contravention of the Act and there's an infringement of the rights provided for in these two pieces of legislation. Then, of course, we can interdict prohibited conduct. We can impose administrative fines. The administrative fine power is very important in terms of serving a deterrent in the market for contraventions and prohibited conduct, because the amount of the administrative fine could be 10% of annual turnover of the previous financial year, or 1 million rand, whichever is the greater. So that is a very significant power that the legislature afforded to the National Consumer Tribunal, and we believe that that is definitely going to assist in regulating rogue behavior in the credit and the consumer protection market. Then, of course, there are a number of other powers we have. The regulators come to us and they say to us, we have registrants in terms of the Act. They don't do what they're supposed to do. They can come to us and they can apply to us for deregistration or a suspension of registration, which is also very important, which indicates that unlawful and illegal conduct won't be countenanced in the market, and there is a way of enforcing that view. In terms of the registrants themselves, of course, can come to us and say, we're not happy with how the regulator is conducting themselves via our registration, and obviously then also give them those rights. And then finally, consumers come to us directly, and we've had a number of those issues where consumers come to us, particularly in this environment, and say, our property has been repossessed, it was sold on auction, it was sold for an amount lower than what it is worth. And that is something that we see increasingly coming forward. In terms of the enforcement of the tribunal's orders, the National Credit Regulator and the National Consumer Commission to be established may institute action in the High Court for the recovery of administrative fines in terms of Section 152(2) of the National Credit Act, and that was, of course, also changed through the consequential amendments to the Credit Act to make it applicable to the National Consumer Commission. I've already indicated that if there's non-adherence to tribunal orders, that is subject can become a criminal offense in terms of Section 160 of the National Credit Act, and there is the possibility of the imposition of a fine, the possibility of imprisonment not exceeding 10 years, or a fine and imprisonment. And those powers are afforded to the magistrate's court. So it would be a prosecution through the National Prosecuting Authority. I've indicated that we can make a finding of prohibited conduct in terms of both pieces of legislation. What then happens if a party wants to institute a civil claim in the High Court or even in the Magistrate's Court, it is sufficient for them to take a certificate of prohibited, a finding of prohibited conduct to those courts, and then the courts only have to deal with the aspect of the amount of the damages, a determination of the amount of the damages. The advantage of that, of course, is that it makes it somewhat cheaper and much less time-consuming not to have to prove that there is a course of action and a prohibition. All our orders of the tribunal may be appealed or it may be reviewed to the High Court. We have panels of either 3 members or 1 member. If it is a 1-member panel of the tribunal, that can be reviewed to a 3-member panel. If it is a 3-member panel of the tribunal, those decisions may be appealed to the High Court or reviewed. I've already indicated who could be litigants before the tribunal. Right now, in terms of the National Credit Act, it could be the registrants, it could be the National Credit Regulator, it could be consumers directly. In terms of the expanded mandate, there are a whole host of new litigants who can come before the tribunal. Could be the consumers, him or herself, or a number of other interest groups or persons who can act on behalf of the consumers, and there are 4 different interest sections that are specifically provided for in the legislation. And all of that is really done essentially to ensure that consumers have better access to redress and to justice in a way. Now, I'm not going to go anymore into the background issues. I'm now going to move on to the second section of our presentation. And on the request to speak to the portfolio committee on the issues where we have a role to play in the current economic downturn, we basically see our role in situations where consumers are under debt stress for whatever reason they may find, maybe because of loss of income, reduction in income, all the types of factors that Gabriel has mentioned. And then, of course, consumers have a right to debt review in terms of the National Credit Act. And then that debt review can potentially result in a consent order. And those are the two things that I first will focus on. And then, of course, also we also wanted to talk about what happens when a consumer wants to get out of credit agreements, when they have now lost their jobs, when they realize that I'm heading for a precipice here. I'm not going to be able to do what I committed to do when I had a job and so on. So I'll also be dealing with that in some respects. Now, in terms of the relevant sections of the National Credit Act, there is an enabling provision in the Act that talks about debt rearrangement, and we're specifically looking at Section 86(8) of the National Credit Act, where a debt rearrangement proposal may be made an order of the tribunal, and that order of the tribunal has the same effect, as I've indicated, as an order of the High Court, and non-compliance with that order could lead to criminal prosecution. And that has very, very significant implications. Then we have to read that in the context of Section 86(7B), which sets out specific circumstances where debt counselors may approach the tribunal. And that has created some problems for us around interpretation. And what we have is basically anecdotal accounts of how debt counselors see these matters and when they can approach us. And then, of course, when debt counselors have to approach the magistrate's court, and then, of course, that highlights the differences between the National Consumer Tribunal and the magistrate's court. The consequences of non-compliance with the consent order are very, very severe, so we need to talk about some of the issues that we have observed in the cases that came before the tribunal, and that how that can further negatively impact on a consumer who's already in debt stress and already experiencing problems. But I'll get into the detail of that. What we currently have is very interestingly, we look at our statistics for last year, our annual report during 2008-2009. We had only about 4 consent order applications for the entire year. Now you will see that we put on that table for you our quarter one and our quarter two statistics. On quarter one, you see that there were 8 consent order applications. In quarter two, there are 149 consent order applications. That is a very significant increase from where we sit. But from where we sit, we still do not believe that the number of consent order applications that come before the tribunal is the number that should come before the tribunal. And I will take you through the factors that impact on that very specifically. And this is the major issue that we have identified. And I must say that a lot of it is anecdotal because we can only make these assessments when cases come before us. We can't really go on anything more than that. What we have seen through facilitators or debt counselors who come to the tribunal is these are well-intentioned people, often very highly qualified people, but there is simply a serious lack of understanding of the processes that has to be utilized in approaching the tribunal for consent or the applications. And furthermore, because the facilitators generally come to the tribunal and they are unrepresented, they don't come with lawyers. So we see that there's a need for us to really look at how do we address that lack of understanding, how do we as a tribunal make it easier for people to approach us, and how do we ensure that we streamline our processes and simplify our processes. Then there are issues around interpretation and application of the National Credit Act. The issues that we battle with and that debt counselors, from what we were told, also battle with is that when our section that enables the tribunal to look at consent or talk about respective credit providers, does that mean that only the credit providers who are party to a debt rearrangement, or does it mean all credit providers? And therein lies the problem. Because if one out of 20 credit providers do not agree to a debt rearrangement, where does that leave the process? And we have been told by debt counselors when we ask them questions around the time it takes between entering into an arrangement and the time it takes to come to the tribunal, what explains that? Because it also imposes a problem for the tribunal. If you have a person who agreed to pay 2,000 rand in total in terms of a debt rearrangement in December 2008, and now they come to the tribunal in August 2009, that means that we have to go back and check with the person, can you in fact still afford to pay the amount that you said you could pay? Did your circumstances change? And we had information before us then that makes it necessary now for us to call evidence, which again protracts the procedure. And the reason we cannot just go ahead and go on the papers in an instance like that is that if the consumer doesn't comply with that consent order that they agreed to, they are subject to criminal sanction and they can be prosecuted for non-compliance. So we have to be very, very careful about that. So we have to look at the issue about who's part of that process, who's not part of the process, how do we ensure that the consumer who comes under consent agreement actually do not have a problem subsequently to meeting their obligations. Then there's another area that's also come out of our cases that is of concern for us, which is the areas around and the issues around payment distribution agencies, the so-called PDAs. But I will come back to the issues of the PDAs or the payment distribution agencies and a number of ways in which we think that could possibly be addressed. But to come back to the issue about whether debt counselors may approach the tribunal when there's a voluntary arrangement or not, or do they go to the magistrate's court. And you have seen that Kavil in his statistics indicated a huge number of 116,000 matters under debt review or application for debt counseling, and 6,000 matters only went through the magistrate's court. So potentially we look at a lot more than 157 cases that should be coming to the National Consumer Tribunal. And for us, we have identified that possibly the problem lies in the definitions within the National Credit Act. In that, in Section 79, where over-indebtedness is defined, it talks about the inability to satisfy obligations in a timely manner. When you look at Section 86.7b, which gives the consumer tribunal jurisdiction, it talks about difficulty in satisfying obligations in a timely manner. Now, when we talk to debt counselors and when they approach us with consent orders, they have difficulty in understanding where do you draw the line between a difficulty, which gives the tribunal jurisdiction, and an inability. And those are the issues that only really becomes clear when you start looking at precedents and so on in the tribunal. The difficulty with setting precedent is that you must actually have the cases to set the precedent. And if people exclude the channel of coming through the tribunal, it becomes very difficult to set that precedent. And that is the difficulty we are experiencing. And we are looking at how can we now ensure that really the people are entitled and who should be able to access a tribunal that's quick, accessible and fair and who meets the mandates of the legislature, how do we ensure that they actually can access that specific service to themselves? Then what we have done around the issues about the rules and people being uncertain about the process and how to do it, we have basically now started preparing what we term practice notes. We are in the process of finalizing a practice note for guidance to debt counselors, which we will make available both through the credit regulator with their permission and on our website and wherever we can access debt counselors, explaining exactly to them what would be the requirement in terms of the rules, in terms of our act, for consent order to be going through the process very smoothly and what impact on time and whether it is appropriate or not. Then, of course, we do education by the NCT itself. And the way in which we do it is when we have a number of consent order applications, for example, in this specific instance, we take our hearings to the areas where the applicants come from. If we have, for example, a facilitator, as we have in this instance, who has about 60 consent order applications that originates from a place like Vereniging, we will go to Vereniging and we will hold our hearings in Vereniging. We've also held hearings in Harrismith. We've held hearings in Gauteng at the Consumer Affairs offices because we want to be sure that in holding our hearings, we become more accessible to consumers and anybody who requires the adjudication services of the tribunal, but it's also an educational opportunity for the tribunal. Because what that then does is it enables people who live in the area then to come to the hearings. So we give everybody a prior notice that we will be hosting hearings in a specific area. And we generally would host the hearings in the town councils or make arrangements with municipal offices to have the hearings at their offices. And they're usually very, very helpful in terms of making facilities available to us. And then, of course, we also file on our website any new cases that's filed with the tribunal so that people become aware. And we inform them of a procedure through which they can intervene should they have a similar issue that is before the tribunal, so that they can intervene and the tribunal then determines that issue not only for the parties before the tribunal but also for other people who may have a similar issue, so that we don't have to delay a final determination. Then, of course, what we also do is we work closely with the provinces. The tribunal is a very small entity. We have a maximum of 12 staff members. We are based in Centurion in Gauteng. In terms of meeting our objective of being accessible, there is no chance that we can do it on our own. We have to work with the provinces. So what we do is we have regular joint education sessions on the National Credit Act, the National Consumer Protection Act with the provincial consumer offices, consumer affairs offices, and the provincial consumer affairs courts, because there are courts in some of the provinces, because that is the only way in which we are sure that even within the provinces, they can then go out also to their satellite offices, which are more rurally based. And because we are able to be quite mobile, we can go out there. We do that. In terms of the issue about the respective credit providers, whether it's one or all of the credit providers, I'm sorry, I went back. one or all credit providers, or five out of six, or five out of five, and so on. I think those are issues that will become clear out of precedence from cases before the tribunal. The issue also about what constitutes an inability to settle a debt or difficulty of settling a debt, that is something that has to also come out of precedence. There could perhaps be some level of clarification through legislative amendments, but I'm not 100% sure that that is actually the route to go, because it is not a very, very quick process, but obviously one needs to see what would be the best way of going forward on that. Let me now turn to the issues around the payment distribution agencies. And first, I just want to go to the next slide and the following slide following on that, and then I'll come back to the specific issue. And this is the issue. When you now have consent order before you, and the debt counselors cannot collect the money and distribute the money, because the money has to be distributed by a payment distribution agency. But there is the facilitator, the debt counselor before the tribunal, and maybe the credit providers. Perhaps if there is any issues, maybe the consumers, not the payment distribution agency. Yes, when we make the order, and we make the order for the payment, that payment has to be effected by a payment distribution agency who is not before the tribunal. That is the difficulty. The second difficulty is also around the payment distribution agency participation in executing the payment process. Number of issues come out of that, which is that how does the consumer know or the counselor know who the payment distribution agency is who's going to handle the payments? How do they know that when they pay the money over to the payment distribution agency that it is safeguarded? How do they know what is the cost that will be levied against that payment by the payment distribution agency? How do they know that those payments will be made in a timely manner as is required in terms of the consent order? Is there a trust account where this money goes into at the payment distribution agency for the safeguarding of the money? Because you, and it's the whole issue around how that is regulated and how then that is linked into this whole process. Because it is a discomforting feeling to say that payments must be made to an entity, and there's not a whole lot of detail around how these protections are built into the system for consumers. And these specific quotes, honorable members, were taken from cases that served before the tribunal by Judge Fleming in these specific manners. And then, of course, the issue around the non-compliance with consent orders, non-payments, and the very, very severe consequences for consumers as a result of that. So the issues are around transparency and the issues around payment distribution agency who's not the party in the proceedings before the tribunal. Now to go ahead then, just to the last slide, just around concluding remarks on prospective interventions. Possibly we could look at the tightening definition. Possibly we can look at how precedent is set. That depends on how many cases comes before us, which again becomes almost a circular argument about looking at tightening definitions. The issue around increasing education and the issue about issuing guidance or practice notes and clarification of the role of PDAs in the issuing of regulations around payment distribution agencies. The issue that I didn't have on the slide that I did indicate that I'd like to talk to is around the so-called voluntary surrender of goods. There is in the National Credit Act provision for a consumer to terminate a credit agreement before the time that the credit agreement terminates in its own terms. For example, if your credit agreement terminates by 30 December, there is a possibility that you can terminate before 30 December. By 30 June, if you have goods in terms of the credit agreement, you may return those goods. If it is that you want to pay up that credit agreement, you pay up that credit agreement. And the difficulty that we have been seeing and where we see in this current time where we have a very significant role is when consumers go, they do the responsible thing, sometimes even before they get into trouble, and they say to a credit provider, I'd like to return my motor vehicle because I've now looked at my financial situation and I realize that I will not be able to meet my commitments. And they return the vehicle. And then the situation then arises where the credit provider has to give a valuation of the goods. And if the consumer is not happy with the valuation, they can recall their notice of termination and they can ask for the goods back. And where we have seen specifically where practice within credit providers becomes problematic is where a consumer goes and says, I'm returning the goods, which is the subject of the credit agreement, I'm terminating the agreement, and I have found somebody who can buy the goods, who in their own right qualifies to credit in terms of their own credit profile. And the credit providers then refuse to sell that item to a next consumer and proceed then to sell the goods in auction. Now, from case law and various benchmarks, it appears to us that when goods is sold in auction, you have about a 20 to 25 devaluation, it seems, because of it being a forced sale. So we had a situation like this before the tribunal, and the parties came to a settlement, and the bank said, yes, well, they agree, there was a better offer than what they reached on the auction, and they basically made good to the consumer to the difference. Another consumer came to us, same type of situation, the bank straight away wrote off the balance of the debt. We now had another situation again, where a consumer was in default in this instance, returned the goods were sold at an auction, and now the dispute is whether the price that was reached at the auction is a fair price for the goods. And then there's a whole host of considerations that come into play there. But what we have seen from the tribunal side is that definitely one, consumers must be educated on the fact that they are entitled to a statement of account that tells them what is their obligations and outstanding amounts on a credit agreement and get explanations for it. Because without it, they can't even know what their total obligations are. What is the debt that need to be rearranged? They won't know. And they won't even know that even if they get an account, they can challenge it. And that it can be really studied and seen whether the interest rates charged on that credit agreement was appropriate, was not bad, that they were overcharged, were they not charged penalty interest that was a high interest that is outside of illegal in terms of regulations. Those types of things I think many people just do not challenge. I think that's very important. I think, and I'm really speaking just now anecdotally and not as chairperson of the consumer tribunal, but my feeling is that many people do probably pay more than what is due in terms of contract. And there is a mechanism available for them to determine what their proper and true obligation is. And we do not see those provisions and those rights in the National Credit Act utilized. It is by exceptional instances that we get queries or requests from consumers to insist that statements of account be granted, that the calculation of interest on an account be reviewed. And those are things they're entitled to do. We don't have a huge educational role. we've seen our educational role mainly around the types of aspects that consumers can come to us directly, and we try to do that. And in terms of how people can access us and how they can make our processes work better. But those are the types of things that we believe really is where we can play a role to make determinations on those issues to really alleviate the debt stress that people are going through, making it easier for people to go through a debt rearrangement process, making it easier for them to adhere to an order that was made when they have managed to come to a voluntary rearrangement. And then basically make their lives just a bit more easier than what it appears at this point in time. So in summary, our role is an adjudicative role. It is by no means as extensive as the role of the regulator. We adjudicate on these cases, we see these issues, we've seen it in the few cases, not that's come before the tribunal, and we are hoping that we can really make a much more extensive and effective contribution to the plight that many people find themselves in today. I thank you, Chairperson and members.
All right. Thank you, Chairperson of the tribunal. I think that this report is very clear and very interesting. I think that we have to hit the road running right now. Let's stick to those three questions per so that we can have a second round if necessary. I see you, Mr. Mareo, head is up. You're noted.
Thank you, Chair. My first question is just in regards to the adjudicators or the judges, in inverted commas. Who are the adjudicators at the tribunal? What are their knowledge and expertise, and what is the requirements for a person to be an adjudicator there? You have indicated to education that need to take place. And I fully agree with that because I'm of the opinion that very few consumers are really aware of what the tribunal is doing, that it is available, and how to approach them. If one takes the National Credit Act and the FICA and all those kind of information was widely publicized and advertised in banks everywhere that you go, but the access to the tribunal is not done on the same level, and one must look from an worst case scenario, and something must be done there. Then, in terms of, you have confirmed that the consumer has got representation directly to you, but if I understood the submission correctly, that, and I think in reality, if you do not have legal representation, it might disadvantage you as a consumer. But as it is, a consumer that goes to the tribunal normally cannot afford an attorney or an advocate. What happens in cases like that? To have fair representation, because very few consumers do understand the legal side of the act and what they can do now, how they can argue that. Then my last point is just on the credit collectors, if I can call it that, the attorneys. And in my opinion, attorneys are probably some of the more regular transgressors of debt collecting. They are in a position where they can easily issue a warrant while someone has got an arrangement, where they can send out the sheriff to write up all the furniture and everything while they've got an arrangement, and they just do that. And what do they do with the cost? To add it to your account. And many cases that has been reported to me in my opinion, with undue recourse and undue reactions by those attorneys, what remedies are there for consumers to be protected in this regard and to be assisted as well? Thank you.
All right, Honorable Mabaso.
I start off with an observation. I just want to check whether the team will agree with the observation. If I say the law is as fair as your pocket, so that if we look at the disparities in our country between those that have and those that don't have, it means that the majority of people are going to be unfairly treated. So can is the law as those experts, is it aware of these imbalances, and what does it do, you know, to correct such imbalances, especially when it comes to consumer areas? But if in a simple way, if one asks and says, what is a tribunal? What is the role of a tribunal? In very, very simple ways, how can it be defined, and how can its role be defined? The last one is, what are the strategies of availing this tool to rural areas, informal settlements, you know, those areas that are very, very far from what we can call regular living. Yet, they are victims of credit. Thanks.
Seemingly, the tribunal is very fortunate. They are only having about 6 questions. Good. All right. I see Mr. Njigala, and I've just incited him now.
Yes, thanks, Chair. Also, let me echo my colleagues the appreciation of the presentation by the tribunal. Chair, my interest is much around what the tribunal has done. To the greatest of extent, what one was picking up is what the tribunal functions and objectives are, with a couple of indications of where what experience they've had, which is quite appreciated. But one comes at odds in understanding precisely, you know, what has been done, except when I think of the case statistics. Maybe the presenters can help and indicate whether that sort of the case statistics are sort of encapsulate or capture, you know, the overall performance of the tribunal. But at some stage, there was an area where it was indicated who may bring a case and what areas does the tribunal cover, you know, declaration of prohibited conduct, interdicts, administrative fines, and the rest of other issues. My expectations, honestly, was that we would have some indication as to what has been happening in each and every of those areas, whether the, you know, applications or requests or whatever have been presented to the tribunal for consideration over and above consent orders, and what has then been the outcomes of those applications.
stands to.
Question from any other member? If there is none, I think that we have to appreciate this input. What I also appreciate a lot is the issue of the consumers being able to terminate their contracts before the end, which was raised with the national regulator. But I think that the explanation was very clear here. But what is also critical, I think that when coming to the issue of education, we have a situation like the farmers, in particular the emerging farmers, who are sometimes highly indebted to the land bank, which does not come to an arrangement we spoke about. That let's say, yes, the farmer indebted to the land bank, the land bank will rather take over the farm rather than allowing this poor farmer to sell to the market so that he can get the market related value for that farm. Do you venture in that? In those things, I think we can take those questions and answer.
Thank you, Honorable Hadimi. To address the Honorable Member Marie on the question about the judges or the what we call tribunal members, in terms of who they are, currently the members of the Consumer Tribunal is myself. I'm a lawyer by training, and I've been practicing for about 23 years as a lawyer. The deputy chairperson of the tribunal, who's also a tribunal member, is Professor Bonke Dumisa. He is an economist and he's a lecturer. The third member of the tribunal is Ms. Laura Best. She works for the Eastern Cape Provincial, for the Eastern Cape Province. She's a member of the Consumer Committee within the Department of Trade and Industry. Then there is Ms. Penelope Beck, who is also a lawyer. Professor Tania Bauker, who is an academic. Retired Judge Fleming, who was with the Gauteng High Court and very senior in the judiciary. Mr. Kolela May, who is with the Black Sash in Eisner, an NGO. Professor Bill Haslam, who is an actuary. Advocate Fatima Namela, who is also a lawyer and who is head of the Gauteng Consumer Affairs Office. Ms. Yasmin Karim, also a lawyer and a member of the Competition Tribunal of South Africa. Ms. Neo Sapote, also with a legal background, but currently working with South African Breweries. And Mr. Mashudu Munyai, who is with MTN, currently based in Ghana. Those are the current members of the tribunal. So you see it's a wide variety of very, very varying backgrounds and experience, and all really bring quite a lot of experience to bear. In terms of the requirements for tribunal members, the tribunal members are appointed by the president upon ministerial recommendation. The Department of Trade and Industry would typically put out an advertisement for the appointment of tribunal members, and they are the ones who decide and determine what are the specific requirements they put forward for people to apply. It's an application process to become a member of the National Consumer Tribunal. In terms of the education and awareness of the NCT, yes, it is for us also an issue that there was not that high level of education and awareness of the National Consumer Tribunal. And that is something, of course, that we have put into our plans to ensure that there's a higher level of awareness and wanting to get into joint projects with the credit regulator around those issues, because they do have an extensive methodology for reaching out and creating awareness. Around the issue of legal representation before the tribunal, what we are also required to be is to be inquisitorial. There's a difference between that and how the ordinary courts operate. In the ordinary courts, they operate on an adversarial basis. How we have to operate when we are required to be inquisitorial is to not expect of somebody to come to us and say, I'm coming to you as a tribunal, and my case is based on section 865A3 whatever, and therefore this is the case I put forward. As long as people give a general sense of the case, it is our role of tribunal to determine is there a right that's been infringed, on what basis is this application brought. We, in most of our cases, and I dare say about 70% of our cases, people come to us unrepresented. And we have a system through which we actually prepare the people who come to the tribunal and explain to them the processes. The tribunal members in the process itself also explain to the parties what exactly their rights are and how they can ensure that they put their cases completely before the tribunal. The tribunal doesn't entirely rely on the parties to put forward their case. If there are issues that impact on the case before the tribunal members will highlight it to the parties and require of the parties to address it on that. And the process we have also developed is when, in preparation for a hearing, we find that there are issues that parties have not addressed, where we may require further evidence, we will alert them to that before the hearing. And we will say to them, your case is about that, there's X, Y, and Z matter that you've not addressed in your case. Please, can you think about it? And when you come to the tribunal, you come and address us on that issue. In layman's terms, it doesn't have to be in technical terminology. If we know, for example, in this issue of the repossession, information that we may have is not in the possession of a consumer. For example, valuation processes, how repossessions happen, how they evaluate. Those things consumers don't have. So what we typically do as tribunal is we subpoena that evidence and we subpoena those witnesses. We don't leave it to applicants to come to us with a complete case. We know what we have to consider in a case and we tell the parties, this is what we have to consider and this is the information, documentation, witnesses we require. We ask the parties, do you intend calling these witnesses? Because if you don't, we will call those witnesses and subpoena them. And that is the way in which we try and insist people to make it possible for them to come unrepresented to the tribunal and still feel that they get a fair deal when they come to the tribunal. In terms of the lawyers, and credit collectors and problematic lawyers, I think I will ask my colleague, Mrs. Scrooby, to deal with this. In terms of the Honorable Mabasa talking about law is as fair as your pocket is deep, you know, that is a very unfortunate fact that many people have experienced in South Africa. And I think that is something that's been overcome to a large extent through the creation of regulators such as the National Credit Regulator, to be established National Consumer Commission, the existence of entities such as the Competition Tribunal, all entities, by the way, within the Department of Trade and Industry and reporting to this committee. So I think that has really gone a long way in addressing those disparities because these are the entities then that start addressing consumer issues for consumers without them having to go into the huge expense of retaining lawyers around that. And of course, very interestingly, a piece of legislation that's going to come into effect in next year, the Consumer Protection Act that I've referred to in a number of occasions, specifically refocuses that imbalance. In that when it charges us to adjudicate cases in future under the Consumer Protection Act, they say, if there is a difference of an interpretation and there's an interpretation that favors the disadvantaged, you as the tribunal are you mandated to follow an interpretation that advantages the disadvantaged. So this legislature has gone a long way in prospectively addressing that imbalance. Now, of course, in the legislation, it is a wonderful, wonderful thing to see. For myself, sitting at the National Consumer Tribunal, I'm really scared. Because how do you apply that type of test in a case before you? When you are told that you must keep the balance of fairness between the parties. So that is our challenge going into 2010 as this legislation comes forward. In terms of the strategies around reaching out to rural areas, informal settlements, what we always think about is, do we only look at people who are currently who currently have credit agreements, or do we look at people who may potentially get into credit agreements? And then it becomes a question around resources and how we most effectively apply our resources as the Consumer Tribunal. How we have tried to deal with it is, like I've indicated, we go out to the areas where people come from with cases, and we hold our cases there, so that at least in that way we can create a level of awareness and understanding that people can say, this is the type of problem you probably face that you can probably go to the tribunal with. And that is how we are trying to deal with that. The issues around the farmers, Honorable Hadebe, I'm afraid I need to think about that a little bit more to give you an answer while my colleague addresses the issue around the Honorable Njekalana's question around what we have done, the indications of our experience that we have had, and the type of statistical questions, and Hazel will be addressing that. But maybe before Hazel goes to that, I'm going to ask Mr. Dave Scrooby just to talk about parentheses, the rogue attorneys.
Chairperson and honourable members, in reply to honourable member Marais' question on credit collectors or debt collectors, or specifically attorneys. I think, as has already been mentioned, the National Credit Act has already made a huge difference. Section 129 specifies the required procedures before debt enforcement. That is the letter that the credit provider or the credit provider's attorneys or debt collectors must send to the consumer before they proceed with any enforcement or collection formally in the courts. And that has made a huge difference. There are about at least three reported High Court decisions where the judges have confirmed that if you do not send a letter to the consumer as prescribed in terms of Section 129 of the National Credit Act, you may not proceed with any legal proceedings. So the courts have upheld that provision and been very clear about it. It's also a great improvement in that 4 years ago, the attorneys or the debt collectors sent a letter saying, you owe our client X, Y amount, and if you do not pay within 10 days, then we will bulldoze your house and whatever else, which they did. Now the letter has to specifically refer the consumer to debt counselling or alternative dispute resolution or to an ombud with jurisdiction in that particular matter. It also needs to clearly set out the charges and interests, etc., which didn't happen in the past. So there the Act has made a huge difference. The tribunal may, as the chairperson of the tribunal mentioned earlier, may investigate the sale of surrendered or repossessed goods and determine whether these goods were sold for the best possible price. I think with time that will also make a difference as there are more cases heard and more precedence is set. Then the court rules prescribe tariffs. The Debt Collectors Association has tariff guidelines or fee guidelines. Attorneys can be reported to their respective law societies who regulate their conduct. But we still
year of instances of the pick handle collectors, you know, voluntary surrender, sign over your goods. And I think things like telephonic harassment, just continual phone calls from a debt collector or attorney's firm can harass and pressurize the consumer into the situation where they will make promises which is impossible for them to meet, or perhaps surrender goods which they needn't have surrendered. I know that the Ombudsman for Banking Services, if they hear of any irregularities in terms of sending the big thugs with their pick handles, or the bank's attorneys taking a shortcut process through the court and not waiting for the prescribed 10 days or 20 days before you apply for default judgment and get a warrant of execution, etc., they will order that bank to write off the outstanding balance, which I think sent out a good message to the banks. I can't say what the tribunal would find, but I have no doubt the tribunal would rule in a similar way to what the banking ombudsman did. Other little things like the case that the National Credit Regulator brought before for the declaratory order, again confirmed the Duplum rule, which has probably been around for more than 2,000 years, but where the interest and the costs and the charges can't exceed the original capital amount. So if you borrow 2,000 Rand, the credit provider can't force you to pay back more than 4,000 Rand. And I think that's very important, confirming this old principle and confirming that it's still part of our law. I know that in practice it doesn't work like that. When the attorneys or the debt collectors have added all their extra charges and costs, you probably pay 6,000 or 8,000 Rand on the example I mentioned. But I believe that the vigilance of the National Credit Regulator in enforcing the National Credit Act, I think we'll have less of these sort of incidents and undesirable practices by attorneys or debt collectors on behalf of credit providers. So I believe there has been a great improvement thanks to that.
Chairperson, honourable members, to respond to the question relating to our case statistics and what has happened in the tribunal, I just want to briefly state, in terms of the tribunal was established in September 2006. The rules of the tribunal came into place in August 2007, and it was only then that we could hear cases before the tribunal. In the financial year 2007-2008, we had 11 cases that we dealt with. There was then an increase in the cases in the last financial year, where we had 26 cases that were brought to the tribunal. Just to give you a brief description of these cases, two were applications by the National Credit Regulator to enforce the provisions of the Act and dealt with deregistration. Two were applications to review the decision of the regulator. Four were consent orders. One related to an application after the conclusion of alternate dispute resolution. 13 applications were for interim relief, and 4 related to matters that could be brought directly to the tribunal. So in the previous financial year of those 26, you can see how the numbers have increased drastically in this financial year. Of those 26 cases, 6 matters were adjudicated on, 3 matters were settled, and 7 were not pursued. And 10 were still pending at the end of that financial year. So that is just roughly to give you an indication of what has happened in the tribunal. The other aspect that the tribunal has dealt with is inquiries that have been brought to the tribunal by consumers. The approach that we used is that we will not turn away anybody that comes to us for assistance. So even if it wasn't within our jurisdiction, we would still say to people, this is where you can go to for assistance. So we dealt with 204 inquiries last year with an average turnaround of 11 days. And a lot of that related to issues that will now come in place in terms of the consumer protection legislation, because a lot of those inquiries related to issues around defective goods, etc. So that is just briefly the issues that have been addressed by the tribunal in the last financial year.
Thank you. farmers issues. But I advise my aging farmers to go to come to the tribunal, but not.
This is. I know, Hadevi, I was going to get to that question. And I unfortunately don't have the benefit of a really light, small act as my colleagues from the National Credit Regulator. But definitely that's an issue also that is covered in the National Credit Act. In the application of the Act, they're not excluded from the provisions of the Act. And obviously, I'm sure my colleague from the credit regulator will be looking into those issues.
All right. Thank you, ma'am, for this response you have made. I think there are follow-ups. And then I request the members not to leave, because the secretariat is going to provide us with the logistics of the next week's public hearings. Please, just if we can hold on. All right.
Thanks, Chair. If I picked up one of the things that there were 7 cases which were not
pending. At the end of the financial year.
Oh, they're still pending. I thought they were not, they were withdrawn or something.
There were 7 that were not pursued.
Can you get a little bit of an elaboration on that? It's an area of interest. But this is quite a sensitive area now. If an issue is not pursued or not crowned, just an observation.
Yeah. Let me say, when our rules were drafted, the rules of proceedings before the tribunal, there was a big question in everybody's mind, saying that in the courts, for example, if you issue out a summons and you don't meet all the requirements, then your matter is simply not taken forward. You don't get a case number, and it's as if the matter was never filed. With the tribunal, the process that we follow is we follow a process of, in terms of our rules, of incomplete and complete filings. So the rules in our table require specific matters to be attended to for a matter to be completely filed so that we can adjudicate on it. So what happens is Ms. Devraj here as registrar will look at an application and she will make an assessment on whether it is a complete filing or not in terms of our rules. She will then inform the applicant that your matter is not complete. For it to be complete, you have to do X, Y, and Z. Then she gives them a specific period of time, and in that period of time, the tribunal senior registry officer, for example, will communicate with the parties and say, if you have any difficulty understanding what it is that you need to do, I can take you through this, explain to you what has to be done. And what then happens often is that still parties don't come back and fulfill the filing requirements. So that is unfortunately what happens.
All right. Is there no other follow-up? We have to close the matter. If there's nothing, 1, 2, 3. Good. All right. Without the wastes of time, I think as the acting chairperson of the day, we have to appreciate the national, the credit regulator and the tribunal for making this presentation. And what is also critical, although other people can take it as something minor, but what I was happy with is that really this delegation which is here is really non-sexist, is non-racial, of which this parliament wants to implement lavishly. So we appreciate that part. You know, that really, I was worried when the national credit was presenting jokes, only Mapo, the old man squat, but then it was counterbalanced by the tribunal, you know, which is good. You know, we really appreciate those small things, but they mean a lot to us as parliament. You know. And then also appreciate the members of the committee. I was very happy again with all the inputs which came from the members. It actually reminds me of what the Supreme Leader of China once said, Deng Xiaoping, that I don't care whether the cat is white or black, as long as it catches the mind, it is a cat. That's what. So with the contribution of made, we cannot even distinguish between opposition and the majority party. The only interest was the issue of the economy of this country. I think that was very great indeed. And also the people who are coming from the media, really we appreciate your support, because whatever we do here is
critical activities reported outside. That's the critical role we are playing. Actually, I appreciated the reports which went through the weekend, in the weekend newspapers, about the peripheral committee's work last week. Those reports were very fair and reflective of what transpired. Let's hope that you continue doing this wonderful job, because you are critical in the maintenance of our democracy. Even my interim staff for the day, as the interim chairperson, I appreciate everything which you have done up to so far. And then the meeting will remain adjourned. And then even the members, you can be released. You only need to call Mr. Njigalana only to deal with the issue of logistics. The other members can be released. Thank you for the wonderful opportunity we had to engage with you. Thank you.